there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco to continue on a little longer than I thought we might with our C.S. Lewis, Inklings, Tolkien, etc. theme and series. And that's because this time my dad had the idea to say, well, since we finished up like the general content, the general overviews, why not actually just do an episode reading through the Chronicles of Narnia, or not an episode, but many episodes doing that. Very cool idea. I think one of the things this might satisfy is over the last couple of years, Rod would, anytime the Chronicles of Narnia would come up, Rod would tell the story about how he would use the Chronicles of Narnia alongside catechesis.
Right.
So he would read that, and we've had lots of questions over the
years. I think he'd at least use Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm not sure if he was all seven.
Okay. And he said, you know, I'd use this, and then we would get questions like, what does that mean? How do you do that?
I still think that's a great question. I'd love for him to find whatever, if he ever wrote anything down on how he did it.
I talked with him when I was just driving with him one day, and he said it. What he meant is he literally just read it. So it's like, You'd read the small catechism, you read the various scriptural texts that go along with catechesis, and you would read the Chronicles of Narnia, so that you sort of had this triple threat. So you had the scripture, you had the systematic outline of the theology therein in the small catechism, and then you had the sort of literary apologetic or imaginary foundation.
Supposings.
Yes, in reading Narnia. And I kind of love this idea of the triple threat. And I think that's probably a good basis for doing this today. But before we hop into specific books, I think we're just going to do an overview episode of the Chronicles of Narnia. We mentioned them in like the Works of Lewis episode, but actually I very intentionally skipped over them quickly because my assumption was that if somebody was familiar with a work of C.S. Lewis, they were familiar with Chronicles of Narnia and Mere Christianity, right? So we were trying to talk about things sort of in the greater orbit than that. So now that we're doing this, we can more specifically talk about the Chronicles of Narnia. I think what's interesting about a bunch of grown men and theologians talking about this is...
About kids' books.
These are really children's books. I think that's probably the starting point, is like, Why would somebody listening to the Thinking Fellows and why would the 1517 Fellowship as a whole care about children's books so much?
Because they're... Well, Adam and I were just talking about this before the show began, that there's a lot of academic debate about the Chronicles of Narnia. And even though they're children's books, they rarely would a children's series of books inspire as much, I'd say high level, wouldn't you, Adam, academic and scholarly debate over their meaning is, if there's a common meaning between the seven books, why Lewis wrote them, why there are seven, why didn't he just sort of stick with the three that are most explicitly sort of theological? If this is a Christian apologetic or allegory, why didn't he just stick with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Magician's Nephew, and The Last Battle? I mean, these are all good questions. If you read them, I've probably read them six or seven times. I just started rereading them again yesterday. They're fast reads. I started reading Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe yesterday at about 1 o'clock. And I think I probably have, and I only read till about 3 or 4. And I think I have about an hour left to be done.
That's interesting. I started yesterday afternoon before I started cooking dinner. I got to 6 chapters while, like, prepping dinner. Like, kind of, like, picking up the book, reading a page, cutting carrots.
And so they do read, and they very much read like a children's book, which is kind of, I think, kind of fun. But they're thick with ideas and thick with concepts that are really worth, theological concepts that are really worth struggling with. Even if you're somebody who's very well read in theology. I mean, there's a reason why they've sort of become bestsellers for the last, what, going on 70 years now, right? Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think, was published in 1950. So we're coming into 2022. That's a long time.
There's a line from Lewis. I guess he wrote it, I don't know, maybe in his 50s. He says that when I was 10, I read fairy stories in secret and would have been ashamed if I had been found doing so. Now that I'm 50, I read them openly.
Yeah.
When I became a man, I put away childish things, including the fear of childishness and the desire to be very grown up.
That's awesome. I love that.
There's a little note before some editions of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is a note to his goddaughter,
Lucy Barfield.
And talking about how she's young enough now that he's begun writing to read them, but by the time he's finished, she'll probably think herself too old to read a children's story, and that by the time he's senile, she'll want to read them and discuss them with him, which is kind of an interesting sort of synopsis of that very same point. I've got to admit, this is going to make some Harry Potter fans mad, but I didn't read Harry Potter as a kid, and then my wife, big on the Harry Potter series. My mom now recently is a Potter nerd. And so I said, well, maybe there's something to this. Maybe I should read these. I could not get past the first three chapters of the first book.
I couldn't either.
I thought, in this, I don't want to sound rude, incredibly childish. And I just couldn't do it. I picked up Narnia yesterday, and I don't know if it's the nostalgia or if it's just quantitatively less childish, even though it's for children, but I could read it no problem. It didn't put me off. I don't know what it was.
You pick up on the fact that they really were written for children in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, with how many times Lewis points out that one ought never close themselves into a wardrobe. You know, this is as if you'd have written this in the fifth, you know, in later on. I remember being told never close yourself in a refrigerator, right? Because like when you used to get rid of old fridges, they'd just sit outside forever, and it was really tempting.
You're supposed to put a chain around it and a padlock, right, to keep kids from going in there.
It was really tempting to crawl inside one when you're playing hide and seek or something like that. But you can tell that it's almost like he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then the lawyers got a hold of it and said, okay, you got to throw in here a couple times that they ought not shut the door of this thing, because it shows up like five times. In fact, Edmund goes in and closes the wardrobe, and Lewis says, which is very, very foolish.
Yeah.
Because one ought never close themselves, shut the door, shut themselves into a wardrobe. And so you do get the sense they really are for kids, but I was listening to...
But the prose isn't like putting you off.
No, and there are some scenes in them that in the 50s I think would have very much thought to have been too much for kids, a little too much death, which is interesting because, you know, if you lived in the 50s, if you're a 10-year-old in the 50s, you were born during World War II. And so, I mean, death was more of a reality to you in the 50s and it is for us today.
Yeah. I got to say my 4-year-old obsessed with dinosaurs, right? But the thing about being obsessed with dinosaurs is that you know they died, and most of the speculation about dinosaurs is how they died. So everything in his world is like, that'll kill you. That'll kill you. He's like, he saw a scratch on my leg. He's like, did you get shot with an arrow? And I was like, no, I didn't get shot with an arrow. He's like, you're right, because that would have killed you. And I'm like, what do you know about this stuff? Well, it turns out that if you're obsessed with dinosaurs, they talk about how did the dinosaurs die a lot.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, yeah. So why do we still read them? I read them because, I mean, I can't get past the themes in it. I mean, it's just every book is just rich with theological themes that make you think, and every time I reread them, I see something that I didn't see before that makes me think and makes me, I think, mostly in my case, think of better and more creative ways to communicate Christian theology to other people.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it, that along the journey you find that it might actually help you develop a vocabulary for proclamation for teaching this, because it helps you maybe grip how people approach or understand or theology grips them.
Yeah. And I really like the, I mean, Lewis says that when he writes that these, that they're not, allegory. I think he calls them supposings. And, but if you're trying to communicate, you know, the story of Christ, and you have a backup like Aslan on the stone table in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the redemption of Edmund and all of that, to me it's just a backup. It's a one more thing. And when Lewis says supposing, it's like this: suppose that Christ had become incarnate in another world, what would that have looked like?
Yeah. Hey, can you move your mic off your beard?
No.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry. When you have a rocking beard, mic placement is very important.
Yeah.
Interesting you should mention Aslan and the table. There's a letter that he wrote, you know, some correspondent, you know, Lewis corresponded to a whole lot of people, right? And there's I can't remember the kid's name. It was a boy who asked him about where he got the idea of the lion. And I guess Lewis says something to the effect, or wrote back saying, that just sort of came into my head one day as I was writing this story. So it wasn't pre-planned, if you will.
No, Michael Ward points out that he says to some other people that before writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he had been dreaming of lions. And then he said to some other people that he had been having nightmares about lions, which kind of, if you remember, we're kind of jumping ahead to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but if you remember sort of how Lewis always presents Aslan, he can be both a dream and a nightmare at the same time.
Right.
You know, he can be a lion that's, his presence is very comforting to you, and he can be a lion whose presence is very terrifying to you. So Michael Ward pointed out that, oh, this is just sort of Lewis did this. He kind of liked to confuse people. And I thought, well, maybe Lewis just realized that as he wrote Aslan, Aslan was both of those things.
Well, maybe Lewis actually knows who God is, who is both
comforting and terrifying.
Comforting and terrifying, yeah. Right? I mean, this scripture is ripe with the many reasons why you should and why you do run from God.
Yeah.
And it's only when God finally comes to you, sort of ends your running, that you realize that, like, that terror is on your side.
Yeah. He wrote lots of letters to kids. This is an excerpt out of one that just letters to children. It says, all your points are in the sense right. So the child was saying, that is this a Christian allegory? Must have been a more grown-up child than most of our children. But
could
I'm
be
not
Emerson.
Could be Emerson, no. Yeah. But I'm not exactly representing the real Christian story in the symbols. I'm more saying, suppose there were a world like Narnia, and it needed rescuing, and that the Son of God went to redeem it, as he came to redeem ours. What might it in that world all have been like? Perhaps it comes to much the same thing as you thought, but not quite. So I kind of like that.
I do like the contrast between a supposing and an allegory, because an allegory tends to have actionable moral lesson, right? And the supposing seems to be, like he says here, telling the story, but for a different land, for a different people. So if somebody observes a not one-for-one between something Aslan does and Christ does, the answer is that Aslan is in a different world, redeeming or dealing with different people than Christ did.
Right.
And so this is him trying to take the revelation of who Christ and God are in the word that's given to Christians and the death and resurrection of Christ and the God for you, and applying what that would look like for other people.
Yeah, don't take the greatest thing from the story away from it, that it actually happens in another world.
Yeah.
Which Aslan himself points out to the children all the time, right? You must know me by my name in your world.
Yeah. It is that is interesting, and probably gives you some license to flub up as
yeah.
well, right?
Yeah. So I think, I don't know what the rest of your questions are, but we should probably go through what the actual seven books are.
Yep, I think we should list the seven books. I would love to address the order, because the set that I
grew up with. Another controversy.
Yeah, the set I grew up with is numbered differently than the set I could buy my children today. So that is interesting and all sorts of things. But Dad, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the seven books are?
We have Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. It's the first one. Again, I was reading Michael Ward over the weekend on this, and he points out that one of the criticisms that Lewis got is that he wrote these all very quickly. In fact, it's interesting that by the time Lewis wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, his friendship with J.R.R. Tolkien had started to cool quite a bit. And Tolkien, anytime he was asked about the Chronicles of Narnia, just heaped coals of hatred upon them. How much he could not stand them.
Yeah, the mental image I get is him putting his head down and kind of shaking it. Yeah. And it's almost like he's embarrassed for his friend, or he can't believe his friend would stoop to such a level.
Yeah.
Too on the nose.
And then literally refused to read anything beyond Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe just because he disliked it so much. whereas Lewis always praised The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings very highly. So, kind of interesting. But he writes Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in 1950. Ward points out that he likely started on it in late 1947.
That's not too quick. I mean, that book's not very long. I mean, that's not overly rushed.
Ward thinks it took him each book about 2 years, and that you're just sort of backed up on the publication timeline.
Does Ward say anything about what prompted him to write it? Because the thing I've always read is that since he was like 16 years of age, he had just had this image of Mr. Tumnus,
right,
in his mind, and he just sits down one day and starts writing a story about him.
Yeah, there's debate over that. He was in a philosophical debate with some
Elizabeth Anscombe.
Yeah, that's it. And some people say that prompted this. The Ward book we should get into maybe at a later time is making a deeper argument. So, for instance, if you were to ask me what binds all seven books of the Chronicles of Narnia together, I'd say Aslan as a Christ figure binds them all together. Not all of them have sort of direct correlations to biblical tales about Christ, right? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe does. I would say The Magician's Nephew does. And The Last Battle, of course, does. But the other ones, you kind of have to just sort of find aspects of the Christian life or see aspects of the Christian life that are spoken to there.
Well,
including, I think, like in The Silver Chair, maybe in Silver Chair and The Horse and His Boy, you know, the fact that the eschaton is now and then, right? That you're kind of part of the Christian life is that you're living in the eschaton, whereas The Last Battle is the actual eschaton, the final things.
The books that borrow the most from, you know, direct scriptural imagery or story are all about ends and beginnings. And so, like, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is both the beginning of the series, but also kind of happens with what is the end of all theology, the atonement and salvation given to a specific group of people by Christ in his death and resurrection. So you have this with Aslan as well, right? And that's an end that becomes the beginning. Then you have the beginning with the magician's nephew, and then you have the end again with eschaton in The Last Battle.
You can kind of see, like, so it's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, 1950, book called Prince Caspian, 51, book called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, 52, Silver Chair, 53, The Horseman's Boy, 54, The Magician's Nephew, which is sort of the creation account, 55, and The Last Battle, 1956. If I were to sort of describe to somebody why Lewis published them like that, it's almost like if you were kind of doing a correlation to the New Testament or to the Bible, you would almost say he started you with the Gospels, he took you through the epistles, and then he read you the creation story from Genesis, and then he read you the end time story from Revelation, which is apologetically not a horrible way to do things.
I mean, it makes sense, right? If you have a new believer, you're going to start them with the Gospels. If you then went into Acts and the Epistles, you would have enough references to the Old Testament that somebody would begin asking, what is he talking about with Abraham? What is he talking about with the Adam? In one man, all men fell, kind of thing. Then you would go talk about the creation and the Old Testament.
And then you talk about the eschaton, and the end of all things.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting watching this kind of from afar, because I don't know if our listeners know I'm on Zoom in Chicago. You guys are in the mountains.
Oh, they know you abandoned us and moved to Chicago. Oh,
yeah. So
why do you got to put it that way?
Only the strong can stay in California.
Well, if you read, so there's a Wheaton scholar of C.S. Lewis, Alan Jacobs, I think is his name. He argues that the central, and he's Reformed of some sort. And his interpretation of the central theme of the Chronicles is, he puts it, or the way he describes it, is disputed sovereignty. Isn't it interesting that a Reformed person, that would be their take, and a Lutheran.
You can see that, though.
Take. Yeah.
Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, between Aslan and Jadis, Prince Caspian, between, that is the story of Prince Caspian in a lot of ways. Yeah. Who is the king? Voyage of the Dawn Treader, maybe two. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, maybe it's both. Yeah. Can it be both and?
Sure. It's a work of literature.
If this is telling you who God is, right, it starts with God actually revealing himself, and then, of course, all the truths about him, including that he is the King of Kings, Sovereign Lord, is going to come true, right?
You should write the book on that, Scott, the Christocentricity, if you will, of C.S. Lewis. And argue against Alan Jacobs.
Boy,
there's your next monograph.
No,
that makes you're welcome.
Nervous. Dr. Montgomery, that's his argument. I mean, I'm basically just making Dr. Montgomery's argument from Myth, Allegory, and Gospel.
Gotcha.
And this too. So
his is that justification is the central.
Yeah, argument. Justification on account of Christ
is a central theme.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with that. Justification and atonement, then you're dealing with the justified and the struggle therein, and then the final realization of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
With sort of like justification in everyday difficult Christian, kind of like, you almost see like a Romans 7-esque in sort of the middle books too. Like the Christian life is not going to be this sort of straight upward line of, progress from 0 to 100, but that it's a messy thing in there, and that God's plan is not always the plan that you would pick, or ever the plan that you would pick. It's his plan. So, and you get that early on. I mean, you get that in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe very early on, that the way that Aslan accomplishes things is not the way that we think they should be accomplished.
Oh, yeah, there's objection to the way he accomplishes things in every book, which is another very interesting sort of theological point in reality, and that's certainly stolen from Scripture, right? Every time Jesus tries to do something, the disciples or religious teachers, somebody opposes the way he's doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting that Lewis makes such a sort of bold argument for free will in mere Christianity. And then most of his literary works, there's like no free will whatsoever for the people involved.
I've heard it argued that there is, and so that's interesting, right? So Alice Milbank, who supervised my MA thesis, for instance, thinks that his literary work, including Narnia, just drips of free will. So that's not even universal. And again,
sure
somebody might accuse Lutherans of seeing the bound will wherever they walk. But I agree with you, and I made that argument.
They literally stumble into this trouble all the time. And then the thing that they want to do, Aslan's always like, don't do that, do this. And they're, and it's over their objection.
I think the final point is for people who argue the free will is that Aslan tells you what the right course of action is, but ultimately you have to take it. And so it's always this last little nugget left for you to actualize what what really has to be done.
Sure. As the lion staring you in the face and telling you to walk right, you're going to go left.
Yes. That's an excellent point. So let's talk about the controversy of the ordering here. So, modern book sets are going to be identical in their ordering except one change, and that's that The Magician's Nephew is going to be numbered book one. It's going to be on the very far left of the set, and everything else is going to fall in order the way you read it.
Yeah. So you're going to get The Magician's Nephew, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Horseman's Boy, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Silver Chair, Last Battle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Didn't Lewis want to reorder it too?
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Did he? I've never read that.
Well, it says in one essay I read on this whole controversy. Why would you read an essay on this controversy? But
because there's an academic.
Lewis sometimes said in letters to children and in conversation at the end of his life with Walter Hooper that he preferred a more strictly chronological order, and as a result, the publishers changed it around to the order you just outlined.
Right. I heard McGrath basically say that he believes that Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was originally... Now, Lewis never said this, and it's kind of speculative, but the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was originally written as a one-off, and that sort of the success and the reception and then continuing ideas woke him up to writing it as a series. And so...
I've read correspondence from... Now, again, I think it should be noticed that Lewis said different things to different people at different times, okay? But I've read letters from Lewis where he said... When he finished The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he knew he needed to keep going.
Okay.
But not that he...
Not when he began penning it, though.
Not when he began writing Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that he knew there'd be seven. I think the bigger controversy is not, again, why is there The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Magician's Nephew, and The Last Battle, but why The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, The Horse, and His Boy?
Well, this is even more interesting. The movies, right, that... produced thereafter. Now they haven't completed them, and I don't know if they ever will, right?
Well, but Disney is a different company than it was 15 years ago.
They absolutely skipped The Horse and His Boy, right? Which is an interesting sort of like as they were making the movie.
Well, they went in, they were heading yeah, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, they just absolutely skip it.
No, oh, no, they went in. They were going more in the original order: The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. They would have come to The Silver Chair, then The Horse and the Boy, Magician's Nephew, and Last Battle, but they stopped.
Oh, yeah. So then the reordering now includes that The Horse and His Boy is third because it occurs during The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, primarily.
It's fifth. But yeah.
But no, but like they're in the new book sets.
Oh, yeah,
it's book number three. Because
I see.
Because it's a story that occurs alongside The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Correct. Yes.
So.
Well, it in that in between time that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you don't get much of where the children are children and then all of a sudden they're adults.
Right.
It occurs in that sort of intertestamental period, if you will. Yeah.
What
this all feels very nerdy. It's sort of like, have you ever stumbled upon debates over which order, like what, you know, the Star Wars series? I don't know jack about Star Wars, but people argue about which ones you should watch first, you know, the prequels or the...
There's some debate about that. Holy cow. Not another episode on the Thinking Fellows do a Star Wars episode?
I think people would
shake their heads.
Yeah.
I could do it, though.
I've not watched the whole thing.
I could do it, too.
Nerds.
Maybe we just have to get somebody else on other than Adam.
Yeah. Oh. That would be...
I can
his little
binge
heart
it.
Hurt just a little bit.
Yeah, I know. Oh.
We've established there's a controversy of order, at least in one or two ways. Now,
I think we should state that it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't really matter. But do the Thinking Fellows... Are we unanimous on a preferred reading order? Adam, what would your preferred reading
order be? I like the original.
You like starting with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
I do, too.
Me, too.
I think
that's
it's more
apologetic.
That's
the order in which I read them growing up. So
I also think it's more apologetic. It's more in line with, if I were asking people to read these for the purpose of sort of teaching them about Christian ideas in a way that they can handle if they haven't had a lot of biblical knowledge, I would always start with Christ and the redemption of Christ.
Yeah, usually when I have an apologetic conversation or somebody new to thinking about theology, they're obsessed with creation, and the number one thing I want them to stop thinking about in order to start doing theology is creation.
Right, me too. And so that's why I would say, I was going to finish and say, with that person, do creation close to last.
Yeah, I might even do it last.
Yeah.
I might do it after the last battle.
Huh. So I think there's, if you're saying, hey, this is a, you're giving this to a Christian child, and, you know, is it, should they then read it in the sort of chronological order of Narnia? Yeah, maybe. Why not start them out with Magician's Nephew? If you're giving this to sort of somebody who's not a Christian and you're trying to sort of hook them a little bit, using this as a, what is Montgomery Cawley's apologetics for the tender-hearted type thing, you know, definitely start with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Man, you want to get them to Christ as soon as possible.
And these are a bit of a two-part project from Lewis in that, you know, he, like Adam read at the beginning of the show, he had sort of an affinity and an embarrassment about children's story as a child, as like a 10 to maybe 13, you know, preteen child. But then Want still has, like, as his memories go back, just an absolute love for this, a formative love for this. And so this is a project of love and of creating something that he would have probably read as a child and would have captured his imagination, and for children to do that. But it's also, I think, part of, I think it would be fair to say, part of his continuing apologetic project as well.
Yeah, and maybe that has, maybe as he gets towards closer to the end of his life, I could see this very much being written as sort of like not only just a literary project, but a project that's also in line with some of his apologetic efforts early on, but then realizing that this is mostly being read by children who are sort of already familiar with the Christian story. And
well,
saying,
and for whose theology is probably boring as all get out.
And then saying, well, they should read it in the order, you know, that it occurs in Narnia. Why not?
I mean, if we take Lewis's life, right? As a child, he's very sort of admittedly disinterested in church, in theology, very interested in fantasy and in imaginings and in fiction. You know, what if he's writing for a child like him, maybe you can actually make theology, make Christ somebody you want to pay attention to as a child.
Although, Adam, I think there's something about the witch being terrifying to the Pevensey children and encountering that, and Aslan being as noble and gracious to the Pevensey children, encountering that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I think some of that magic would be lost if you've already encountered Jadis and Aslan in The Magician's Nephew in a different way. I don't know. There's a mystery to Aslan as...
Mm-hmm. Can I have the coffee?
In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there is a buildup until he appears. And even a mystery to the witch, besides with Edmund, until he appears. By the way, my new grandchild is going to be named Edmund.
Coincidentally, I think it's actually is a subconscious thing with where my wife was born in Edmonton, but yes. Oh.
So anyway, I just, there's something to that to me that, and after that, every time you encounter Aslan in the other books, you're encountering him with a pre-knowledge that you have from reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
Which is, there's not as much sort of buildup to Aslan's appearance. You know, there's an expectation of it. Sometimes he doesn't even appear.
You're almost making the argument about, like, why Paul had better success with the Gentiles than the Jews, right? It's like that this story of God redeeming you is actually more exciting to a Gentile who's never heard about a promise or a God who loves and redeems. But for the Jews, they're like, well, yeah, I mean, Yahweh's been saving our butt every, you know, couple hundred of years. Well, you know,
yes. Type of Aslan thing. Comes to life for the Pevensey children because of the expectation of the animals in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in a way that is not the same in The Magician's Nephew.
So you're saying basically if you read The Magician's Nephew first, you become like the animals. You know who Aslan is. Yeah. You kind of are awaiting him.
Yeah.
You know that he's going to come redeem. But if you read The Chronicles of Narnia for the first time, you're actually from the perspective of the children. You're encountering Aslan for the first time.
You probably actually know, too, going into it, that he's going to be able to defeat the witch, which as a child, you don't know when you're reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You're not sure about that. In fact, you're really not sure about it once, you know, she does to Aslan what she does to Aslan, you know, and you will if you read Magician's Nephew. You'll know
who's who in the zoo.
Yeah, you'll know who's the most powerful.
That is interesting. Any thoughts on that, Adam?
Apart from ditto?
Apart from ditto.
I mean... Scott, you started off. You actually said my name. I thought I was waiting for a question in there.
I tried, but turn into a question.
I mean, I don't. Well, I think The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I like how you made that distinction for somebody like somebody who knows the story, who you know, the Christian, if you will, reading the second order, the chronological order. I mean, yeah, either way is fine. But
yeah,
for if this is, and indeed it is, Lewis cannot help himself but be an evangelist and an apologist. I mean, that his whole world...
That's a good point.
The reason why there's... One could argue the reason why there's so many Christian themes in the whole Chronicles, even though he may not have intended in some sort of systematic way, planned it all out from the get-go, which he didn't. The reason why there's so much is because that's just... Lewis's world. That's his thought world, his worldview, if you will. But The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, how do you describe it? It's surprising, or it's very, and I don't know of a better term to use, but kind of existential. It hits you. It's like,
you don't know.
Yeah, and I don't want to dump like arbitrary or foreign categories into it, but it's like Lewis is preaching law and gospel in a way. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where he's presenting law with the...
There's definitely the deep magic is certainly the law, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The deeper magic is something else. only he was there when that was written.
Well, it's almost like there's a little buildup of, you know, what Luther would call Anfechtung, angst, anxiety. Like, it's, my most recent encounter in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is watching it again on the screen. And you know when, and I know how the story goes, but when they tie Aslan up and there's that like that bohemian scene where people are it's bizarre, you know?
Yeah.
And then he's killed. It's not just a story. It hits you. You're like,
yeah, what? Good luck not shedding a tear.
Yeah. So.
It is interesting because, you know, the New Testament is so wrought with Jesus casting out demons, encounters with the devil are throughout. But at the time of the resurrection, that part isn't there. But you can almost imagine reading Lewis that the devil and his angels are celebrating at the death of the Son of God.
The origin story. Just prepare yourselves for next week when we do The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe specifically. I have questions about the origin story of Jadis as presented in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Mm. So pay attention to it because I'm going to ask.
So that's what we're doing. We're doing each book?
Yeah, man.
Oh, I guess I got to read it again.
Yeah, we could get into some theological trouble here. Well, not trouble, but it is interesting, right? Aslan is not bound by the deep magic. He's above the deep magic.
He is not a tamed god, right? Yeah. Or a tame god.
Well, and no one's allowed to tell him about the deeper magic since he's the one that
created it.
Created it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was there. Yeah. Where were you?
He's above it, but Jadis is a agent of the deep magic, funny enough. So very interesting if you're Lutheran and you go, law and gospel?
So I'm with Adam. I'm not... trying to say here that Lewis was like a closet Lutheran putting themes, although I do know one or two closet Anglicans that are closet Lutherans, but
or not closet Lutherans.
I don't think he was doing that, but I think, excuse me, if you're trying to present accurately New Testament themes, you're going to run into law and gospel.
Wouldn't that be what...
Even if you don't say this is law and this is gospel, yeah, you're going to run into them. And as you sort of represent them very specifically or thematically or in a literary fashion, they're going to come through. There is a bit of sort of having an ear tuned to hear them.
Well, I was going to say, I think if you're a Lutheran and you were reading this and you couldn't find law and gospel in it, even if it's not intentionally specifically law and gospel, I don't want to say Lewis does that, you would say this isn't an accurate representation of the scriptural story at all, because that's how we believe the scripture speaks. That would be our confession about what the word of God speaks in these two words, law and gospel. And we would say that if Lewis is drawing a picture of who God is, who God says he is, who God is for you, and what the scripture says about that, and we don't see law and gospel there, we would not think this was accurate, and we probably would pay no attention to it, pay no mind to it.
Yep.
And so it's not that as Lutherans we're inserting this in there, but saying that this is a good picture of the story, and being a good picture of the story, that means we are going to be able to explain how long gospel at work, even inside of Lewis, as a sort of long gospel getting him.
Right. It working on him more than him specifically working it out for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the unique Lutheran interpretation and reading of this is going to be able to proclaim long gospel to people from the work of Lewis.
Or Pauline.
Yeah. That's even better. So,
or biblical. We could say,
or evangelical.
Or biblical, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm teaching that class on Romans at church for the last like 16 weeks. I don't know how if you spend any time really going through Romans, I don't know how you can say that law and gospel is just a Lutheran category. It's like, yeah. No way.
Well, great, guys. Great introduction to the series. So I want to be careful to say the next episode in this series that we do will be The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But between here and there, we're going to do a Christmas episode. I haven't exactly decided what that'll be yet, but between now and our next recording, I will. So we're going to do a special Christmas-themed episode for the week of Christmas, and then following that, we will begin with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We will then get through those seven books, and then after that, at some point, we do have to go finish The Formula of Concord. So just trying to think out loud these timelines for the listeners. So we have several months of recording to do. So if you've been giving me episode ideas, if you've emailed me or you plan on emailing me that, just know that we do have, as of now, a couple months worth of content. So if you do send an idea, it'll be in a couple months. It'll probably be a late winter, springtime episode. So we appreciate you listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye.